This is Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. We're going to talk today about research released over the weekend online by the New England Journal of Medicine showing the difficulty of controlling type 2 diabetes in young people. Our guest is Dr. Phil Zeitler, a member of the Writing Committee for the Treatment Options for Type 2 Diabetes in Adolescents and Youth, called the TODAY Study. The TODAY researchers randomized some 700 young people between the ages of 10 and 17 with type 2 diabetes to one of three regimens. First, staying on metformin alone. Second, using metformin plus rosiglitazone. Or third, metformin plus an intensive lifestyle intervention. The primary outcome of the study was a comparison of the treatment groups with regard to their rate of treatment failure, defined as a persistent glycated hemoglobin level of 8% or higher. Over the course of roughly 4 years of follow-up, about 52% of those on the metformin alone regimen showed treatment failure, somewhat less, 47%, of those on metformin plus lifestyle intervention showed treatment failure, and lower still, 39% of those on metformin plus rosiglitazone failed treatment. Our guest is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado Denver School of Medicine. He is chair of the TODAY study. Welcome, Dr. Zeitler.
Good morning.
So you mentioned in your discussion that you found the failure rates with metformin monotherapy to be higher than that seen among adults. Did you expect that?
No, we really didn't expect that. Pediatric diabetologists had pretty much assumed that metformin was generally a very effective medication based both on adult studies as well as our clinical experience up till now.
And your study then has huge implications, I would guess, for public health. I mean, the editorial that accompanies the paper remarks that a few decades ago, type 2 diabetes was relatively rare among this age group, and now it accounts for about half the diabetes in the cohort. So what sorts of treatments are needed, and what are the implications for the health of these kids as they get older?
I think the main implication is that monotherapy or relatively unaggressive therapy is not effective for a lot of these kids, and that we need to be thinking about early initiation of more intensive therapy right from the beginning rather than waiting for them to fail on initial therapy such as metformin. The hard question is knowing exactly what that intensive therapy should be. The study did not find a great usefulness of a very intensive lifestyle intervention to get these kids to change their diet and activity habits, which was a disappointing finding and points to the need probably and unfortunately to look at more intensive pharmacologic approaches in these kids at, near the time of diagnosis.
So would that imply use of insulin earlier in this group?
Perhaps. There is there are very few other options. There are no other drugs that are approved for use in this population, and we really don't know much about their efficacy or safety in adolescents. A number of studies are underway to look at those questions in pretty much all of the classes of drugs that are currently available to adults. Insulin is approved. We all know how it works. And there are data emerging in the adult literature that early initiation of insulin may be beneficial to preservation of pancreatic beta cell function. The problem, unfortunately, is that insulin brings with it a number of challenges due to both the need for injections, which actually most kids get used to pretty quickly, but increased management burden because of the need for testing blood sugars and the risk for weight gain in a population of kids in which we are trying to reduce the weight.
So what's new in these findings, Dr. Zeitler, that your colleagues might use immediately? For instance, you found that there were different treatment responses based on sex and also on ethnicity. Can you talk about those briefly?
I can, and they're very intriguing. They were pre-specified analyses, but we need to be careful to point out that they were not primary outcomes, and we're somewhat exploratory in the analysis, though again they were pre-specified, as we expected to find some differences between the different ethnic groups. The most intriguing findings really relate to one, the particularly poor response of African American kids to metformin, and they had a very rapid failure of metformin as a monotherapy agent. And the girls, African American girls, were particularly responsive to the addition of a second agent. So I think that we need to be thinking very carefully about individualization of treatment for groups such as African American girls. Perhaps the message is that we need to be looking at them somewhat differently than we do, for example, Hispanic children, in which metformin was more close in its efficacy to the additional therapies.
The rosiglitazone use is it's restricted now, and yet you found few adverse effects related to the treatment with rosiglitazone, at least in among your 700. Would you care to comment on that?
Yes. So the decision to use rosiglitazone was made in 2002 when the study was first being designed. And at that time, it made a lot of sense for a variety of reasons. There were a number of characteristics of rosiglitazone that appeared to be very attractive, mm-hmm. one of them being some evidence that it actually would help preserve beta cell function mm-hmm. From adult studies. The second reason we wanted to use it was that our underlying hypothesis here was that insulin resistance of puberty was contributing greatly to the natural history of the disease in these kids, so that those kids who were obese and perhaps relatively compensated were entering puberty, having insulin resistance of puberty occur, and they were no longer compensated. So our underlying hypothesis was that reduction in insulin sensitivity during that period might be a very important thing to do to help protect beta cells and give them a better long-term outcome. So rosiglitazone at that time was seen as one of the best agents for reduction in insulin resistance, and also was a nice parallel to the attempt to reduce insulin resistance through a lifestyle intervention to reduce weight and increase activity. Rosiglitazone subsequently came under scrutiny for concerns about cardiovascular effects in adults. We have looked at that. What I can say is that there were no gross evidence of cardiovascular effects in these children. We do have echocardiograms on these kids that are in the process of being analyzed, so I can't really state with any certainty that we will not find some more subtle effects on cardiac function. And it's also important to remember that a 700-person cohort is really not large enough to identify safety concerns that might be occurring at relatively low rates. So we didn't find anything here, but I'm not sure that it really means that we would be recommending rosiglitazone as that second agent. We see this more as a suggestion that additional pharmacologic therapy of some sort is going to be required in these kids because monotherapy is not as effective.
Okay, fair enough. If lifestyle is widely touted as the best preventive for diabetes, why do you think that lifestyle interventions are less effective than added drugs? Is it just too late by the time the disease manifests itself to use that strategy? And I'm asking the question because last week there were a couple of British studies that said lifestyle interventions in diabetes were thought to be more effective than they turned out to be. And so I'm wondering whether the lifestyle interventions should start well before the child is even suspected of having diabetes.
I think that's correct, that one of the messages of this study is that once these children get diabetes, it's hard to treat. So clearly what is really needed is prevention of the circumstances that lead to type 2 diabetes in these kids. I think that was well pointed out in the accompanying editorial by Dave Allen, that the message here is that we need to prevent the circumstances, because once the kids get type 2, they're very hard to treat. As to why it was particularly ineffective, we are analyzing that now. We have quite a lot of data related to process variables, what aspects of their lifestyle did they change, what aspects didn't they change, who, in fact, among the group maybe did respond better than other children. Can we identify what sort of child is going to be responsive to lifestyle change? So I can't give you definitive answers about that. The speculation would be that if you think about it, for a child to develop type 2 diabetes at the age of 13 or 14 as opposed to 60, they must have a more toxic lifestyle than the average adult with type 2 diabetes. It simply makes sense that in order to get in this circumstance as a theoretically healthy young person, they must be further out on the curve of poor lifestyle. In addition, these children are really quite obese for the most part. And thirdly, the family and social environments in which these kids live produce the circumstances that led to their diabetes in the first place and are very difficult to change. So I think a combination of the fact that these kids have a pretty entrenched poor lifestyle that the family system in which they live is difficult to change, and that their degree of obesity was, for the most part, quite extreme, probably explains why we were not able to get enough change to see an effect on glucose output.
Yeah, as Alan says in his editorial, that you know, we need incentives to produce and purchase healthy foods and build safe environments that require physical movement and not simply the prescription of more and better pills. All right. Well, it's really a very complicated problem, and we'll look forward to your later findings, Dr. Zeitler. And I want to thank you for spending time with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
That was our 153rd edition, and all the earlier editions may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from Journal Watch, whose website is jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Dr. Danielle Schurer and I thank you for listening.